You're listening to the Electric Sheep podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this episode, you can hear a recording of a special panel discussion that took place at the Masonic Lodge in the Andaz Hotel on Liverpool Street in London. As part of the East End Film Festival, myself, Electric Sheep editor Virginie Selavy, Nollywood scholar Nicola Woodham, filmmaker Jennifer Ice, and horror expert Jim Harper are discussing various presentations of cults and secret societies on film.
This is an Electric Sheep event, and I'm Virginie Selavy, the editor. So tonight we're exploring secret societies through a number of topics. First is going to be witches, then we're going to have something on Jack the Ripper and the Freemasons conspiracy, and then we'll talk about religious cults. That will be in the form of a panel. So first we're going to start with Nicola Woodham, who's a film writer and filmmaker, and she's going to talk about witches.
Okay, so first of all, I just want to focus in a bit and let you know what kind of witches and covens I'm going to be talking about. You'd agree that witches in cinema cover a really broad spectrum. We have the films that are loosely based on actual witch hunts in early modern Europe. We also have the broomstick, black cat and cat type, The Wicked Witch of the East and Harry Potter. But I'm going to concentrate on the ones that are portrayed as living secretly among us, who could be your professor, your family friend, or your neighbour. So the films I'll be looking at are George Romero's Season of the Witch, 1973, and Sidney Heyer's Night of the Eagle, 1962. These films expose societies of witches living among normal people. For this, read everyday Western suburbia. They are law-abiding folk, keen to get on in the world. And in this way, I like to think of them as society witches, as well as secret societies. They occupy commonplace spaces. I'm thinking cul-de-sac, as opposed to, say, John Rowland's exotic castle locales, or even, as we saw earlier today, the closed fairy tale reality of Argento's Suspiria. So the witches that I want to talk to you about are the type that would lend you a cup of sugar. So what makes this such an enigmatic subject matter? Well, for me, I think the films about these witches tap into the fear and unease that comes with the idea that any secret society could exist in close proximity to your own society. We like to believe that we know people, that they are who they say they are. Films about witches suggest that you can never really be sure. These are people so close to you that you won't see them coming. I think that the way directors like Heyers and Romero put this across is by really emphasising how normal the worlds the witches move in are. The horror is built in, it's rooted in the quotidian. It's the way witchcraft is accommodated by the ordinary in the films that I want to talk about. I want to show you some clips that I think have a certain camp black comedy that to me is priceless, but also illuminates this. Okay, so I'll just start with Night of the Eagle. So southern provincial England, for those of you who don't know the film, husband and wife, Tansy and Norman Taylor, have recently been to Jamaica, where Tansy was introduced to witchcraft. Back in Britain, she is convinced that this practice has provided all the good luck for her and her rising academic husband to proceed with the husband's profession. So, but she soon realises that her arch rival, who also hopes that her husband at the same college gets promoted, she also realises that this competitive wife is also a practising witch. On the surface, these are society wives battling it out over the best crumpets, bridge and committee teas. But underneath, they are all calling on the black arts for wealth and prosperity. The main thrust of the film, I think, is to ask the question, does witchcraft exist or is it all just a coincidence? Norman lectures in superstition and neurosis and fears for his wife's mental health as she gets more involved in witchcraft. He throws away her charms, pats her on the head and says, "Don't be so silly." But his fortune takes a dive when he does so, and he is accused of harassment. Tansy fears the worst, and their bad luck increases, resulting in near death for Tansy. So, can we play clip one, please?
What are you doing?
Where did this come from?
What is that doing on the deck, Norman?
Well, mine got stuck, so I had to move yours. What about this?
It's a souvenir.
Of what, for heaven's sake?
Of our stay in Jamaica. It was a gift from Caruby's.
Something you remember it by?
You wanted me to have it.
It certainly looks like it. Is that the only reason why you keep it?
Do I need a better one?
It's supposed to mean something, isn't it?
Of course, darling. It's a good luck charm. That's why you're so successful. Come on, dear, it's time to go to bed. After all, 3 years of trouble.
You know, it's the whole way that the representation of witchcraft practice is entwined in the prosaic that I think is so effective in Night of the Eagle. Tansy hides her good luck fetishes all around her well-kept house. It all seems like business as usual, but if you look a bit closer, you may find that your enemy, the rival society wife, has tied a voodoo doll into your lampshade tassels. What I love here is the way her acceptable ritual arrangements of objects that Norman has financed around the home are interwoven with this unacceptable independent activity that he disapproves of so much. But the gendering of witchcraft is something that I'll come onto in a bit. On to the next film, but Season of the Witch. Okay, so views on this film vary from Romero's, who felt that it wasn't successful. He describes it as an attempt at a women's lib film that sort of failed. But others think of it as a lost treasure, and I definitely think of it as the latter. So again, we have the bored housewife, Joan, who her successful husband is away from home a lot of the time. She has a mild anxiety disorder and wild dreams where hubby is torturing and controlling her. Joan joins a local group of women who have formed a coven. And witchcraft gives Joan the excuse to have an affair with a man years her junior. She believes her spells bring him closer to her. But really, this is a case of her just getting drunk one night and calling him up and asking him to come over. It also explains the loosening of her grip on reality that makes her mistake her husband for Satan and shoot him dead. Metaphors in this film for control are really quite heavy-handed, and the plot is quite out there. But even the dream sequences and delusions have a deadpan reality to them, more so because of the shaky acting and jumpy editing. But here we find a merging of fantasy and the banal that Romero went on to push to its limits. I think the use of the motifs of the witch and the zombie, all constructs based on West African Yoruba-derived religions, candomblé, voodoo to name a few, combined with modern activity like shopping and harbouring material goods, is at the heart of Romero's work. Witches and zombies here are metaphors for the consumers who fetishise material objects to gain power and social acceptance. Okay, so here's my offering, my analysis of these films. I want to attempt to tie together the idea I've talked about of the neighbour who isn't who they say they are with the portrayal of the domestic and the influence of modern life on all of this, and say a little bit more about the role of women as well. Okay, so my basic argument has been that the filmmakers raise this question about how can you ever really know someone? Is real really real? The most familiar faces can be false ones. That moose the neighbour brought round earlier really does have a chalky undertaste. It's not your imagination. The films have a strong theme of paranoia, and they really draw on images of women and men losing their hold of reality as they get more and more involved in witchcraft, or try to work out if witchcraft is real or not. But why would this be so interesting around the period of their making, and still hold some interest now above and beyond the drama? I think these films are saying something about a particular unease people felt about the changes modernity brought about in the mid-60s to 70s. Suddenly your neighbours are getting rich quick, moving around. What was familiar no longer is. Friendship and routine that once gave us a foothold on reality is now shifting and in flux. The filmmakers proposed this question. In this environment where we no longer know our neighbours well, how can we be sure that they are who they say they are? And to add to that, previously, when people wanted to get to know you for who you were, not for what you owned, wasn't it all a lot easier? These are aspirational families who are putting professional success and material gain above and beyond their familial relationships. Tansy and Norman have recently moved to a new area for Norman's job, and Joan's husband isn't around to help their child, etc. Old values of kinship, familiarity and routine are being replaced by mobility and professionalism. Overarching all of this is the idea that women are the gatekeepers of safe domestic places, the ones who keep order, the ones we can trust when others fail us. These films pick out the horror of women turning their back on their previous roles as homemakers and carers. The horror is the horror of the maternal figure not being who she says she is. She is the ultimate figure of the familiar made strange. The motif of witch or witches' covens echoes the fear that one, more and more, we cannot be sure people are who they say they are, and two, that if these untrustworthy people are women, then it's much worse. So, this is a complex motif where the witch wives are seen to abandon their housekeeping, read, tending to the charmed material objects, or rather commodity fetishes, that hubby funds, for their own worryingly independent magical activity and the use of fetishes and spells. On top of that, the witch also stands in for the new fearful, distrusting relationship with the neighbour and those close to us that comes with modernity and an investment in the commodity. So on one hand, you've got this real value for material wealth and power portrayed in the films, but on the other, a portrayal of the cost of these, upheaval and paranoia. Okay, so to round up, the filmmakers I've talked about emphasise the normal and suggest that the familiar can be made strange at the drop of a hat, and this makes us ill at ease. They say a secret society can also be part of your society and be barely recognisable. Your neighbour might be a witch, so who can you trust? Next time you're up for promotion, watch your back.
Right, shall we move on to Jack the Ripper and the Freemasons? Obviously the perfect venue for this, and maybe some of you watched From Hell earlier in here?
Mm.
Yes, yes. I think we have, we're going to show a clip from that.
That's yeah, we can start off with a clip
yeah?
From,
okay.
From Hell, if you like.
And this is Alex Fitch, Assistant Editor of Electric Sheep.
Who is this? Poor Angela's just dark. Comes in his own free will, perfectly prepared, humbly soliciting to be admitted to the mysteries and privileges.
In all cases of danger and distress, in whom do you put your trust?
In God.
How did you find out about the unfortunate man, Charles?
Well, he has that kind of cleverness you're sometimes finding in the middle classes. A cheap sort of intelligence, but effective, nevertheless.
Hmm. Thank God there's not something you're well aware
of. Yes, thank God.
The sight of the solid earth. Never to reveal our secrets, under no less a penalty than my throat be cut across, my tongue be torn out by its root, so that I be buried in sand, cable's length from shore.
To quote a character in an episode of the longest-running animated sitcom on TV, there is the truth, and there is the truth. In the case of Jack the Ripper, it's doubtful we'll ever know the Ripper's identity. Too much time has passed, and there are too many conflicting theories, many equally plausible to sift through, to find the true answer to his or even her identity, motive, or even the number of victims. So to misquote The Simpsons, there are the facts, and there are the facts. This much we know. 10 women were murdered in the environs of Whitechapel between April 3rd, 1888, and July 16th, 1889, and at least half of these were probably murdered by the same person due to their modus operandi. If we can't be sure even how many women were killed by the same murderer, let's go with the common consensus and say five for the sake of argument, then what do we know about the crimes that is documented and can be extrapolated to form some kind of theory? Signs, symbols, graffito, and symbolic acts. In several of the murders, the killer performed his act in a ritualistic manner. The disemboweling, mutilation, and presentation of the bodies, as found, bear a resemblance to ritualistic sacrifice as supposedly carried out by Masonic elders. To quote Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution by Stephen Knight, a book first published in 1976, which, although not the first to suggest a link between the crimes of Jack the Ripper and the Masons, was certainly the tome which crystallised this idea and led to further extrapolation of the theories within. Knight compares the murders to the depiction of Masonic ritual in the work of William Hogarth. The engraving, The Reward of Cruelty, ostensibly a caricature of the medical profession, in fact shows a Masonic ritual killing in progress and bears an uncanny resemblance to the mutilation of Mary Jane Kelly on October the 8th, 1888. Hogarth was a Mason and one of the first to expose the fraternity. There are Masonic symbols in many of his engravings, but this particular work was his most frank. The detail of the engraving is inadequate to tell whether internal organs are missing, but the lower portion of the body has definitely been cut out. Kelly's heart was cut out, and Hogarth's victim has suffered the same treatment. And in one version of the engraving, the left hand of the victim lies across the left breast in the same position as Kelly's. One final parallel between the Masonic murder in the Hogarth engraving and the butchery of Kelly is that the final Ripper victim had her legs and feet skinned. Knight extensively goes on to find similar parallels with other Ripper victims, making the similarities very hard to ignore. So the question is, was the Ripper a Mason, someone with a grudge against the Masons, or just a fan of the work of William Hogarth? Again, this is open to conjecture, but there is also the case of the Goulston Street graffito, found just over an hour after the discovery of the corpse of another canonical Ripper victim, Catherine Eddowes, in the early morning of September 30th, 1888. To quote Knight again, Police Constable 245A Long found in the bottom of the stairs leading to number 108 to 119 Goldstone Street buildings a piece of a blood-stained apron, and above it, written in chalk, the words, "The Jews are not the men who will not be blamed for nothing." If you haven't seen this graffito in print or written on a wall in a Ripper movie, the notable and most ambiguous part of the text, other than the triple negative, is the word Jews, which is spelt J-U-W-E-S. Is this a misspelling of Jews, or, as many Ripperologists, Knight included, extrapolate to be a reference to the three Masonic spectres, Jubilo, Jubilar, and Jubilum, three apprentices in charge of building Solomon's temple, who supposedly killed their master and then were also executed in a ritualistic way, as depicted in Hogarth's engraving and in the style of the Ripper murders? So we have killings committed by person or persons unknown, some graffito, and an MO which all suggest a ritualistic connection. When all we have is site-specific sculpture in the form of human dismemberment and some ambiguous scrawl in chalk on a wall, which was quickly erased to prevent further public disturbance, it's no wonder that the crimes of the Ripper, ignoring the evocative and provocative royal connection, have led to so much intrigue, interpretation, and misinterpretation. Signs and symbols mean one thing to one set of people and one thing to another. An entire subgenre of horror fiction came from Egyptian tombs and the late 19th century translation of the symbols above the tomb entrances. Until complete understanding of the hieroglyphs was made, they could have meant anything from "beware of the dog" to "please don't nick anything you find within, it's disrespectful" to "ye who enter here will suffer the mummy's curse." And it was the latter meme that created a legion of shuffling, bandage-swathed spectres in countless horror movies. The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb always makes me worry that 4,000 years from now, after an apocalypse or two has wiped out our civilization and its hard disks, archaeologists may come across one of our mysterious buried tombs, and assuming wealth to be found within, will ignore our strange yellow and black signs, which actually warn of the danger of buried nuclear waste with a poisonous half-life of 10,000 years, and stumble irradiated within. So what have the ritualistic disembowelings and mysterious chalk message given to us? There is a potency to signs and symbols which also have a half-life, leaving a radioactive trace throughout history. In the graphic novel From Hell by Alan Moore and Eddie Campbell, the film of which you saw a clip just now or may have seen in its entirety this morning, the novel presents a thorough and psychological and psychogeographical study of the Ripper and his crimes. Unlike the film, which is another Ripper whodunit, the book is a whydunit, as it tells you who the Ripper is from the start, physician William Gull, and then, using extensive historical records and artifacts in its bibliography, explores his psychological motivations and their impact on history. Moore has Gull as a lifelong sociopath who is visited by the Masonic wraths, Jubilo, Jubilar, and Jubilum, in a possibly stroke-induced vision, and then he uses this revelation to inspire his reign of terror on the poor women of Whitechapel, to destroy their conspiracy to blackmail the crown due to an illicit child conceived between a prostitute and an heir to the throne. Moore has the Ripper as an iconographic presence, who not only carves symbols and ritual into the prostitutes of the East End, but into history as a whole, due to the lasting nature of signs and symbols and their appropriation and misappropriation. The comic book portrays the crimes as something so deeply entrenched in our subconscious, foretold by Hogarth and made popular by the penny dreadful newspapers of the day, that they allow his Ripper and his essence to move backwards and forwards in time, like a stone dropped into a still pond, with its ripples travelling in every direction. So not only do the crimes and their symbolism travel into the future, creating copycat murders throughout the 20th century, but also backwards, as portents that predict the arrival of the Ripper in the late 19th century, through such predecessors as Leather Apron, who were abroad in London years before. This trans-temporal journey even allows the Ripper himself a vision of the future as he dismembers Mary Jane Kelly. With bloody knife in hand, the Ripper finds himself transported from the charnel house that he's made her lodgings into, to a modern office of the future, where the footprints of his acts have helped shape the brutal and sensationalist world we live in now. Truly it can be said that I helped create the 20th century, shouts the Ripper at this unfathomable vision before him. Unfortunately, the film is more prosaic than the book, and this quotation becomes a random, unqualified soundbite in a movie that evokes the book only in style rather than content. Hilariously, one of the producers, when asked about the film in pre-production, was quoted as saying, "We're going to be faithful to the graphic novel. But we're making the lead character 20 years younger, giving him psychic powers, and making him fall in love with one of the prostitutes." The mind of a Hollywood producer is a labyrinthine place indeed. To show how the Ripper has moved into other fictions, such as portrayed by From Hell, Pam, could you play the clip from Murder by Decree?
Miss Holmes, what is this mumbo-jumbo? The handshake and the ring, Watson, are archaic rituals preserved by the 33rd degree members of the secret order of Freemasons.
We are not a secret order.
Your existence is no secret. Your rituals and membership are secrets you guard as closely as you may, which is why you rule with the writing on the wall.
I am responsible for the safety of the people of this city, and their right to go safely about their business.
Does that include the right to murder and mutilate?
You fool! Jews would have been slaughtered in the streets if I had not had those words removed. Do you know the theory, given the greatest credence among the common people, that this is a blood ritual carried out by some Jew whose religious fervor sensitized in such a prostitute to offer as a sacrifice to his God? If those words had been seen, not a Jew would have been safe. Their houses and their shops would be destroyed.
Nonsense, Warren. The writing had nothing to do with the Jews. You know that as well as I do. You did not remove that writing to protect Jews against anti-Semitic rage. The Jews, or Jewes, referred to, are from your own secret society of the Royal Order of Freemasons.
Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson there confronting the secret society of amazing mustaches. Thus freed from time and space and context, the Ripper has become shorthand for a set of barbaric crimes that have somehow diminished over the past century, diluted by far greater crimes committed by humanity against themselves.
Well, H.G., which is it to be? The past or the future?
Oh, the past. Surely you want to be Cleopatra.
The future.
Now, why the future? Because I belong there.
Yeah.
Within three generations, the social utopia will come to pass. There will be no more war, no crime, no poverty, and no disease either, John. Men will live like brothers and on terms of perfect equality with women as well.
Oh dear, less of the past. Yeah.
I can't agree with you. Check. Really, you're astonishing, H.G. And Mr. Wood, you're theorizing, you managed to ignore the facts.
The evidence of human history is that we're in a cosmic charm of ours. Mankind has not changed for 2,000 years. We're hunted. That's how it is. That's how it should always be.
Malcolm McDowell there as H.G. Wells and David Warner as Jack the Ripper. So the Ripper becomes a literal time traveller in such varied sci-fi fare as the excellent Time After Time, in which he steals H.G. Wells' time machine, yes, he built it himself, who knew, to travel to the 1970s to continue his crimes. He also possesses a crew member of the Starship Enterprise in an episode of Star Trek, written by psycho author Robert Bloch. He also becomes a phantom in other recent sci-fi TV series, such as Babylon 5, where he becomes a demonic interrogator, and Sanctuary. Doctor Who has yet to confront the Ripper on screen, but in the novel Matrix, it turns out the Ripper is an evil version of the Doctor himself, while in a comic book series being published right now, it turns out the killer is a shape-changing alien from another lizard-shaped race called, wait for it, the Juez. The Ripper has travelled into many fictions, coming across Sherlock Holmes, who else could solve an unsolvable crime, in the films A Study in Terror and Murder by Decree, as well as the stage play Sherlock Holmes vs. the Ripper by Avengers writer Brian Clemens. This in particular seems appropriate, as one of the suspects briefly considered by the police in the 1880s was an actor playing Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde on stage, whose performance was so convincing they thought he must have been a serial killer in real life. Even the long-suffering Inspector Abilene, who gets assimilated into other fictions, was unable to solve the Ripper murders in real life, but is press-ganged into investigating lycanthropic murders in the recent film remake of The Wolfman. Some of these extracurricular activities of the Ripper have some worth in trying to understand his crimes and their symbolism from another angle. Many have none. I'll gloss over David Hasselhoff's struggle with the spirit of Jack the Ripper in 1990s Arizona in the film Terror on London Bridge. Don't ask. But it shows the potency of his crimes as Chinese whispers, as phantoms on the covers of penny dreadfuls, as scalpel marks on our collective subconscious. From social realist engraving to comic book and inevitable computer game, the signs and symbols of the Ripper are here to stay, even if we don't actually know what they mean.
Any questions on Jack the Ripper?
Just a curiosity. You know how generally the recent Ripper cases, say in Boston, or there's one in India, they were all very similar. They were copycats, essentially. From what the profile was, it wasn't actually ritualistic. It was sexual motivation for mutilation. I was just curious if you knew any correlation between the original and the copycats. Just out of curiosity.
Well, that's the kind of ripple in time that Alan Moore certainly postulates in From Hell, that because freed from their initial Masonic meaning, the acts of Jack the Ripper have had such a profound effect on the human psyche that they continue to influence people subconsciously throughout time. I mean, you know, I think that's quite an intellectual look at things, which diminishes obviously the acts of real murderers, which are horrific, but I think that's how certainly Moore would look at it.
Okay, we're now going to move on to the panel on religious cults.
Typhoon! It killed 55 people in time!
I think that's what's interesting in the whole film. I suppose you're familiar with the plot? Yes?
What?
No? Oh, right, okay. So just to sum it up briefly, so it's this young couple who's moved into a new apartment and they have some rather strange old neighbours, and then Rosemary becomes pregnant. And it could be that, I mean, the film remains very ambiguous. It could be that maybe it's just the delusions of a pregnant woman who's not having a very good pregnancy, or it could be that actually she is the victim of a satanic society, including the neighbours and her husband, who turns into the devil. But the film really plays on that ambiguity between, is it a conspiracy, is it a secret society, or is it all a nightmare that comes from her disturbed mind? What do you think about that aspect of the film, that ambiguity between... and she does say, oh, it's not a dream, it's real. What do you think of that aspect of the film?
I was just going to say, it kind of harkens back to what you were saying earlier about secret societies hidden in plain view, because it is, there's this, you know, very... a bit strange, but, you know, very kindly elderly couple who lives in, I think it's the flat next door, who all of a sudden is very interested in her pregnancy and want to help out a lot, and being very nice people, a bit maybe overstepping the boundaries sometimes, but they turn out to be pretty much the ringleaders of the satanic cult and the people who, you know, originally targeted her. And you'd never know, because they're nice, normal people. They look like humans. They don't look like demons. Neither
until you've seen a few of those films, yeah. And you realise it's always the nice ones.
Yeah, it's always the quiet ones, isn't it?
And there is that aspect as well that you were talking about, where I've only just noticed this, actually, which is quite interesting. The bed. You have this bed with the flowery motif on the bed. And that doesn't look very satanic, really. That looks quite normal and a bit boring, really.
But isn't that what you always expect from suburban Satanists? It's always going to be a bit kitsch.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and you have that very much in Season of the Witch as well, so it really sort of ties in with what you were saying. And in many of these films, you have this aspect of, is it paranoia, or is it actually, is this really happening? And you do have that in other films like High, for instance, which is very much about paranoia. And the secret conspiracy from the Hasidic Jews really feeds into the character's paranoia. It's almost like an external manifestation of it, but it's more about him than it is about any kind of real secret society.
I was going to say, do you think the ambiguity of people's identities, whether they're human or devils or witches or whatnot in the 1970s, is as... much an evocation of American foreign policy at the time as it was in the 1950s. In the 1950s, everyone was terrified about the Cold War, and so there were reds under the beds and your neighbour might be an alien from another planet. But in the 1970s, when America was entrenched in Vietnam and no one knew who the enemy was, whether, you know, someone's on your side, whether they're Viet Cong or whether they're just an innocent Vietnamese, that's the kind of paranoia that's infusing these films.
I think it infuses films in the 1950s. It's hard to get away from the fact that the aliens in War of the Worlds are obviously communist. Where the films like Rosemary's Baby became scary was that you could no longer isolate and categorise the enemy as something away from you. The problem for the people, Rosemary, is that the enemy is in her home. It's not a foreign enemy. It's not something that you can put some distance, both physical and, you know, psychological, between you. It's scary because it's her husband, and he's such a nice guy. Aliens, we always manage to beat aliens, but it's harder trying to accept your family are using you as a satanic surrogate. That's what's scary about these films.
I think that's true. I think particularly in Rosemary's Baby, you've got this kind of drawing on the idea of pareidolia. So just the kind of idea of, you know, taking anything from our experience and making that into a story. And I think, you know, for me, on the first watching of the film, it worked really well because I really wanted it to be ambiguous. I wanted, you know, there to be this great ambiguity. But I do feel that the film is let down at the end by this kind of sort of literalising of the child. I sort of fluctuate because, I mean, I really like the cot that the baby is in, and just the sort of the way that the neighbours are all standing around at the end, and they're still the neighbours, but they're going "Hail Satan," and it's just you know, you recognise, oh, okay, so that's the one from, you know, the guy on the stairs. And so I think you know, it's really interesting the way it kind of just allows you to sort of pick up all the way through the film these kind of little kind of triggers, and you really get a sense of her paranoia. And I kind of thought I wish that it hadn't all been answered for us at the end. But then as you watch it again, I kind of get really fed up with Rosemary and just think, yeah, oh, come on, you know, just go and see the doctor that's a good doctor and just, you know, get the hell out. But that's why those women exist in the films, because then we become incredibly involved. And
Well, it's a horror film trope, isn't it? It's people say, oh, why would you go down into the basement? But if you don't go into the basement, there's no film. So you have to go into the basement. That's the way it is, you know. So she had to sort of, you know, be very naive and trusting to begin with. Yeah. So that she didn't all of a sudden say, okay, something's, you know, 20 minutes in, something's wrong here.
It's the domesticity that makes it worse. Yeah. You know, if she was manacled to a slab in the basement rather than being, you know, molested on the chins.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, the ultimate expression of that, it's not so much about a secret society, but there's this Polish horror film from the early 80s called Possession with Sam Neill and Isabel Ajani, where it's a bit like Tarantino's From Dusk Till Dawn in the sense that it completely changes genre halfway through. But the first half of the film is like your typical art house movie where a marriage is breaking down and they shout at each other a lot. And then halfway through, Sam Neill's got this private detective to track his wife to see if she's having an affair, and the private detective goes into her apartment and gets killed by the monster living in her bathroom. And you're thinking, I wasn't expecting that.
Well, it's a bit, yeah, it's kind of, the thing about Rosemary's Baby is that it's so normal. Like you say, the domesticity of it. There's nothing prompting her paranoia really to begin with. I mean, okay, she's having a few weird dreams, but she's, you know, there isn't, as far as I remember, there isn't a history of mental illness that they bring up to begin with. So maybe she's a bit fragile, she's young, she's having her first baby, it's a bit odd. But then looking at something like Pi, I can't remember the main character's name, but in that he's set up as a complete mental to begin with. He's on medication, he's nuts. I mean, there's no ambiguity in that because you know, okay, yeah, there could actually be this Kabbalistic cult, but in a way it doesn't matter because he's crazy anyway, and, you know, it's not, it could be real, but there's not enough sort of ambiguity to make you want to care or actually try and figure it out. You just think, guy's a nut bar. What do you expect?
So these films always play that to a to a varying degree, but you always have that sort of balance between paranoia and truth.
Besides, when women in horror movies pay attention to their paranoia and work on it, ends up like Polanski's Repulsion, where she's completely wrong and she's killed people.
Yeah,
she's listening to a paranoia, but that doesn't work either.
Well, it's all, you know, it all goes back to Freud and even the ancient Greeks, you know, hysteria being connected to the womb and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, women are meant to be more seen as being more paranoid and hysterical to begin with. So we're the ones who get most easily preyed upon, I think, by, you know, secret cults and, you know, mental illnesses and all that. So we're kind of the easy ones.
I think the ultimate, you could argue, and I think people have, that women are the secret society. And I think, you know, looking at Argento's Suspiria, especially for me, I mean, I think his films are kind of just I just think he wished he was born a girl, really. I mean, this, just the way the camera kind of lingers in all female populated spaces. I mean, not just for the sort of flash or thigh or tear, you know, I think there's a tenderness there in the way that he follows groups of women in the changing room or the swimming pool. I mean, all the way through Suspiria, it's just about sort of girlish friendships. Okay, if you want the erotica lesbo thing, then you've got it, but as well there's the there's that intimacy. And I think you know, in that film you've got the secret society that's explained, but I think more implicit is the sort of the secret society that is just the dance academy.
But it seems to me that this film is sort of the opposite of all the witches films, as well as a way of responding to the same thing in a different manner. Because all the films about witches are really about this sort of anxiety about women's power. And these are all like 60s, 70s films. And this one is sort of the opposite. It's about the anxiety about the woman being controlled by older people and by her husband. So it's kind of like this sort of battle going on in the 70s for women's emancipation, and I think, and I'm going to see an example, I think, in The Wicker Man, and you can see the battle for the woman's body, who's controlling the woman's body, and Rosemary is losing control of her body. And of course, this can be something that you feel through pregnancy, because obviously your body is taken over by something else. But it can also be something that is what society takes over, because they're telling you how you should behave, what you should do as a parent, etc., etc. So you lose control of your own body because you have to procreate for society to carry on. So I think it's quite interesting the relationship between this film and the films about witches.
Yes. I was just thinking. I mean, Rosemary's baby, yeah, I mean, because I guess you've got the particular kind of it's sort of where is the sort of issue about women's liberation in the way it's sort of been transported onto Rosemary in this, whereas the women's the female witches are kind of seen as being not the kind of people that kind of want to control their families. They're actually probably trying to run away at a very fast speed from their families because they're incredibly bored with that sort of life. I think there, I mean, where you have got witch films where there it is, the main characters are sort of female, maybe it's just about one witch or groups of witches. I think they come for, you know, they have an incredibly bad rep. I mean, when I first started researching this, I was kind of like, you know, God, women get such a bad deal in these films. I mean, what they're actually doing. I mean, you have some great moments where women are behaving very badly in witch films, and they can be really kick ass, and they can do all kinds of things like shoot their husbands or whatever happens in The Craft. I think there's some quite, I think the girls
and bullies, yeah,
they're quite cool, yeah. And they can be, they're sort of the outsiders, but suddenly they can be really cool. But I think the argument is within the films that they can only be cool temporarily. They can only be undisciplined temporarily before they have to kind of go back into the sort of usual confines. So I don't think it's that they have to stay a secret society, really, because society ain't going to deal with these kind of stroppy women.
And not only do they have to go back to their confines, but normally they're shoved back into their confines.
Yeah.
They're missing a few limbs, if they're alive at all, yeah.
And I think, in a way, I mean, they're just a sort of reaction to the fact that women are assimilated into patriarchal society and are doing all these things just kind of as a matter of course. But I think the exoticisation and the sort of impossibility of the films is a bit of a, is a sort of a reaction to that. But I get a lot out of those films because I think seeing women behaving badly has got to be good always.
But also, I mean, with Polanski's films, it's always slightly dangerous to psychoanalyse the author. But whatever, didn't his parents die in a concentration camp? Or
his mother, I
think. Yeah. And so thinking of the secret societies, particularly in Rosemary's Baby and the fearless vampire killers, it seems to be also that they look like us, they act like us, They dress a little bit funny, but surely these are nice people because they're humans. But then you pull back the curtain at the end of the room, and the mirror reveals that they're all vampires.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually, because you have this whole strand of films about secret societies, where the secret society is not something that is attractive or interesting, but it's something that is very sinister and, in fact, reflects what is happening in mainstream society. I think this is what's happening in Rosemary's Baby, and I think that's why what you were saying made me think of, do you know a film called Dr. Mabuse the Gambler, this early Fritzlang film, in which, in fact, the secret society is a criminal society, and later in the sequel, in 1933, that criminal society really reflects what is happening in Germany at the time and the rise of the Nazi Party. So it's. I think that's a really interesting point. Do you want to have a look at the Wicker Man?
Do sit down, sir. Sharks are so much better absorbed than these pets. Please. Now, those children out there, they're jumping into the flames in the hope that the god of the fire will make them fruitful. Really, they would hardly. After all, what girl would not prefer that the child of God to that of some acne scar like his own? And you engage them in this actively. It's most important that each new generation born on some other baby pet. Here the old gods aren't dead. And what of the true God, whose glory, churches and monasteries have been built on these islands for generations past? Now, sir, what of him? He's dead. Can't play. He had his chance at the modern parts. Do it. What? It's very good. I'm sorry.
So, more naked women and procreation, it seems a theme, 1970s film involving secret societies. What is at stake, as far as you're concerned, in this film? I think the naked women and procreation thing is slightly different here, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting that it's... Well, no, I suppose in a lot of these films, the Satanists do win, but it's interesting that it's a film where Christianity is crushed, where the supposed hero doesn't survive to the end, and it's actually shown that the libertarian religion, even if it involves sacrifice, is the one that can become dominant if you have a closed society where there isn't much outside influence.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny because what is ambiguous here is the portrayal of this. It's Sergeant Howie is not a particularly positive character, a very sympathetic character. Although the secret society is also a bit sinister, so it's kind of like it's an interesting film in that aspect, I think.
Although I suppose he does go through the ultimate Christian act, which is martyrdom for his faith. So in that respect, he's fulfilled his religion's promise.
So yes,
I always find one of the most fascinating things about this film is not sort of the clash of religions, because they really aren't sort of warring religions in that sense. I mean, they're not kind of two sides of the same coin. It's the idea that Sergeant Howie comes in and says, "You're evil," and Summerisle says, "We don't recognize the concept of evil." So there is no way for Sergeant Howie Christianity to actually fight against this religion, because they don't recognize the sort of the same way of thinking that he does. And it's also interesting, as you were saying, that Sergeant Howie is portrayed as a fairly unsympathetic character, because I think a lot of times Christianity can be seen as very restrictive and punishing and those sorts of things. And, you know, the idea that martyrdom is the highest sort of expression
of
your
faith. It's not so much religion, it's libertarianism versus institutionalized morality.
In most witch films of the 1970s, particularly in the Western culture, the witches are not actually witches, or they're benign witches, and Christianity stamps on them. And I think this is, The Wicker Man is a response to that, where, for once, someone stamps on the Inquisitor. And certainly in films like The Devils, there may not even be a secret society. And if there is, it's benign, and there's not a shred of the supernatural about it. It's just, you know, another religion. And so it's interesting to find a film that takes the same viewpoint but punishes the other person. Normally the witches get burnt at the stake, but this time they punish the Inquisition.
And yet we still feel sorry for Edward Wood, would we?
Do we?
I'm not sure.
Okay. I do.
Because that ancient religion has been portrayed in an interesting way, maybe not completely positive, but you feel interest for something precisely that has not been repressed by Christianity, I think. I don't know if everybody feels this way, or if it's just been...
You sort of touched on that, but the idea of women running amok isn't really that terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't feel sorry for him at the end. I don't feel sorry for him at the end at all. I think he's just been annoying the whole way through. I mean, he doesn't end up sleeping with... Is it... is it Britt?
Britt Elkin.
Yeah, he doesn't sleep with her, does he? I mean, this man's mad. I mean, it's the whole way through, he's just incredibly annoying. And I think... I suppose the problem maybe I've got with that, the representation of paganism there, is that the women, the young people, are sort of all kind of controlled via the Lord Summer Isle. And in that way, I suppose it doesn't quite live up to its libertarian standards in a way. Mm. But I enjoy the film immensely, I suppose. Just for its kind of really good depiction of pagan motifs and, you know, sort of the final scene and everything.
Is there a connection for you between the film and 1970s Britain? Does it say anything about Britain
like
that in that period?
Well, I'd say it's certainly Lord Summer Isle's pagan society is probably a wish fulfillment for some of the audience. They might think would like to escape the 3-day week and the strikes and the petrol shortages and go to a place where you can dance naked around the fire and have no worries, if nothing else.
There's also this contrast between the country and the city, I guess. Do you think that's representative of the time or in any way?
Or is that still the case now? I mean, you know, in the media, the city is shown to be the place that you want to go to. It's the kind of the achievement. Well, if you stay in the country, you're somehow, I don't know, decadent and not living up to your full potential. I mean, to go slightly off topic, there was a case recently where the Daily Mail, in their infinite wisdom, approached this woman who had moved from the city to the countryside, and she believed that she was just being interviewed about that topic. And then when it appeared in print, they'd put words in her mouth saying that she had gone to the countryside because she believed she could indulge in lots of swinging and other rural activities, and, you know, she was unable to beat the male lawyers in court, and so just had to go with the fact that they destroyed her reputation in the local community.
Wow.
Welcome to the 21st century.
I found it interesting to note that over the past 10 or 15 years, there's been a couple of dozen Japanese horror films which set up a very distinct pattern. The main characters come from an urban area, usually Tokyo, and the plot of the film basically involves them going for some reason into the countryside and discovering that even today, the people in the countryside are not like the people in the cities. They have these weird religions that look a lot like they did 300 or 400 years ago. And the clash between the two, between, you know, the city types who want their mobile phone to work and would like to get some kind of wireless, and the country people who are still practicing what is primarily a benevolent religion with some fairly malevolent twist. And that's happening a lot in Japanese horror films at the moment. And it's quite, there's a kind of microcosm of the Japanese urban mind, they do seem to think that there's a lot of bad things waiting in there once you get off the good roads and you get away from phone lines.
So the country sort of becomes this isolated world, represents this isolated world where you don't know what might happen to you, it's the unknown.
Yeah, your mobile phone doesn't work, you're in. I don't think it's necessarily accurate, but horror movies play to real fears, and there does seem to be a thread of a fear amongst the urban Japanese that you don't want to go into the countryside. Yeah. It's the same thing we've had for ages, the endless jokes about brothers and sisters in the countryside, and families like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm. But these have kind of died down for a bit. I mean, that was 1973. Mm. But they're really current, these fears, in Japan at the moment. No, it's very interesting.
Okay. I'm not too sure what time it is. Do we have time for questions? Are there any questions?
I was going to ask about you, witches in Japanese movies. If Japanese movies is your speciality, how do you get witches compared?
Well, the witch has never really become in Japan, the witch has never really become a negative figure, because there are still a lot of women, both young and old, who have a function within the area in terms of religion and a temple and so forth. There are cults and religious ideas that are considered dangerous, but you're as likely to come across an old woman who can exercise or cleanse a building in the middle of Tokyo as you are in the middle of nowhere. So they've never been through the process of being forcibly converted to another religion and having their religious officials painted in a negative fashion. You're as likely to find what we would call a witch turning up in a movie studio to cleanse the set before they started work.
So it's all benign white witches, then?
To a large extent. I mean, it is part of their religion. No one's ever managed to successfully tell them their religion is wrong. Obviously, as they've got further and further into the modern world, these things tend to die down, but I can show you 4 or 5 movies where, about making movies where the supposed witch turns up and has nothing to do with the plot at all. She's just there to cleanse the set and make sure the set goes shooting as well.
But considering there's this leitmotif in a lot of Japanese horror where there's this fear of technology and modernity, whether it's the cursed videotape in The Ring or Dream Home. Certainly in urban-based modern Asian cinema, there's a fear of modernity and technology, where you will kill to get the best apartment view in modern Hong Kong, or you'll play a videotape that contains a curse.
I think part of it is that they spent a long time in the 80s being excessively commercial and very, very successful, and then the bubble burst, and all of a sudden, you're looking at these things you've got around your life, your flashy car, your great apartment that's not Japanese style at all, your video, and these now symbolise the failure that your life has gone through. They're not status symbols anymore, because you can't afford to run that car. You had to move your entire family into a two-room apartment, so a big apartment, it's not good for you anymore.
But it's interesting, though, that the horror of modernity as represented by technology in the city isn't countered by a romanticising of the countryside.
No. You'll find a lot of films where they concentrate on the violence in urban cities. I mean, you played a particular Suicide Club,
did you? No, we did that.
Yeah. There's a lot of films where Tokyo is presented to be an utterly, utterly dangerous place to go. You need to get out to the countryside, but it's much safer there. You can do it the other way around as well. People juggle the fields, particularly at a time when half the world is scared.
Okay, I think that's all we have time for. That's it. Oh yes, and we are at www.electrocheapmagazine.com if you're interested. Thanks to Nicola Woodham, Jennifer Ice, Alex Fitch and Jim Park.
If you enjoyed this podcast, which featured a recording of the Electric Sheep event that took place at the Masonic Lodge on Liverpool Street in May 2011, why not come along to the next event? On Tuesday, the 20th of September, Electric Sheep, in collaboration with Stranger Tractor Press, is presenting an evening of film and talk at the Horse Hospital near Russell Square. This event is part of the London-wide celebration Scala Forever, about the legendary cinema near King's Cross. And on Tuesday the 20th, the evening will start with a discussion hosted by Electric Sheep editor Virginie Selavy about the life and times of the Scala, with Jean Giles, former Scala film programmer, who's currently head of content at the BFI. They're joined by horror maestro Kim Newman and Mark Pilkington, publisher of Stranger Tractor Press and a regular Scala visitor. The talk will then be followed by a screening of the demented horror porno comedy Thundercrack. For more info about this and all other Electric Sheep events, please go to electricsheepmagazine.co.uk/events. The Electric Sheep podcast was recorded, introduced and edited by Alex Fitch, and there'll be another episode online next month. Thanks for listening.